Good morning.
Hi.
I will use this in a minute. Just getting organized. We've got our team here from Biz News. You know we have a little office opposite Checkers. You're welcome to pop in and have tea anytime.
Yeah.
And I'm delighted to be here. This is not what I do, but we are now members of the Hermana Society, and it's a real privilege to be talking with you today. Can you hear me okay in the back? You can.
That's all fine. Thank you.
A couple of years ago, a very good friend of mine said that I needed to start reading a little more widely. I do read widely. I read a heck of a lot. But he recommended me to a chap called Howard Marks. Now, those of you who've been following the MoneyWeb story and the Biz News story and maybe my story would know that for many years I used to go to Omaha to the annual general meeting of Berkshire Hathaway, where Warren Buffett, who is now 94, and Charlie Munger, who passed away last year, this year at 99, would hold fort. 2006, I went to my first conference there, and I was told by a good friend, it's about time we went because we don't know how long these guys are going to last, and this is the end of Americana when they pass on. Well, that was 2006, and this year was the first year that the two of them worked together. I wrote a book about my experiences there and what I learned about Warren Buffett, and that book has done very well. It's sold more than 10,000 copies, which in South Africa, lamentably, is a bestseller. But my friend, Sean Pesch, who's one of the top asset managers in the world, in fact, he received an award 2 weeks ago in London for being number one of all global funds in the UK from an organization there which is highly respected. He said to me, read this guy, Howard Marks, and I did. It's a very good book, took a while to arrive from Amazon in the UK, in the US rather. And in it, Howard Marks talks about second level thinking. And that's what I want to talk to you about today, because our world is contaminated by first level thinking. It's contaminated by people who believe that simple formulas and easy answers are all you need. I've been involved in the internet since 1996. I left various positions that I had within the media industry, Sunday Times, Star, Finance Week, SABC, for a period. Spent a little time in corporate. And while I was in APSA, I was a member of the executive committee at APSA in the early 90s, a colleague of mine called me into his office and said, come and have a look at this thing. He just got back from Redmond, where IBM has its headquarters. And because APSA was such a big client of IBM, he got the insight into what was happening in the latest technology. His name was Dr. Alwyn Berger, and he was head of technology at APSA at the time. Incidentally, he was subsequently poached by Standard Bank to become their head of technology. That's how it goes in banking, I guess. But he showed me this thing called the internet, and that was in 1995. I make plans quickly to leave APSA, get back into my industry, which was media, and started MoneyWeb in 1996. MoneyWeb was supposed to be my life's work. Those of you who know my story will also realize and remember that it wasn't my life's work because, let's just say that I had a disagreement with the corporates that was brought in during my sabbatical. I departed in 2012, started Biz News with my wife, Jeanette, who's here, in 2013. And we have celebrated our 10th anniversary here in Hermanus at the Civic Auditorium in August last year, where we had 200 people who came and joined us, and it was sold out within a couple of weeks. We saw that was working quite well, so we then had the Biz News Conference, which we had five editions of in the Drakensberg. We brought it here. There were 500 delegates. Also sold out very quickly, 28 keynote speakers, the best investment brands in the country, as well as some of those that Rod mentioned. But let's get back to Howard Marks and second-level thinking. So what is second-level thinking? It's about looking at things differently, looking in a deep way, complex, convoluted sometimes, but actually embracing complexity. And potentially our best entrepreneur in South Africa, many people will say it's, I don't know, Christo Wiese, and he certainly deserves that accolade. There are a number of others, Johan Rupert. But to me, the best entrepreneur in South Africa by a country mile is Adrian Gore. And Adrian Gore has built Discovery into a substantial business globally. He has many international partnerships, including one in the UK and a company called Vitality, which I'm going to revert to a little later. And Vitality has got 1.7 million customers who get medical aid from Vitality, despite the fact that the UK has got National Health. There's a story there too on second level thinking. But Adrian Gore keeps telling us that the way to be successful in business, in life, is to embrace complexity. Sadly, we now have a society where everyone's an expert. Just go and look at Twitter or X. Everybody seems to know better than the next person because of something that has been forwarded to them, which has then been forwarded on, they forward on to other people. It's the bane of our lives at business. We keep getting this crap sent to us, which unfortunately most people are totally unaware of, that it is generated by those with agendas. Vladimir Putin is quite a crazy guy, but he's also quite smart, and he runs what are called troll farms. What is a troll on the internet? A troll on the internet is somebody who puts out misinformation. So we have troll farms. All they do all day is put out misinformation. And the useful idiots amongst us pick it up and say, wow, I like this. Oh, I want to watch RT. It's got good stuff. Oh, of course, we didn't invade Ukraine because of any other reason than they're bad people and Nazis. And then they pass it on to the next person and the next person. And the first level thinking contamination spreads. Nobody stops and says, damn it, why do they have to have troll farms? Damn it, why is nobody emigrating to Russia? Why does everyone want to go and live in America? But they're supposed to be the worst people in the world. Yet there's a long list of people who'd like to emigrate there. Why? That's too difficult. That's complex. That makes the world more complicated than we want it to be. Anyway, I'm going to go into a couple of specifics for you now, and let's start with the election. It's 3 weeks and 1 day ahead. And I'm indebted here to a book that I've read recently. What happened at our conference? I asked the keynote speakers to please give me a list of books that they can recommend that we can pass on to our community. And they did. And one of those books was a book called Guns, Germs, and Steel. Written by Jared Diamond, it sold over 1 million copies. In fact, 2 million, the last count. A New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize winner. You must know, if it's got all of those things, pretty good book. It's fantastic for anyone seeking knowledge, and everybody here in the 3UA organization, or clearly that's what you're here to do, you're seeking knowledge. I would strongly, strongly recommend it as something to read. But in the book, which goes to 550 pages, hidden in amongst there is something that is very relevant to South Africa. Well, a couple of things relevant to South Africa. I'll get to the second one in a moment. But on page 303, so almost two-thirds the way into the book, where he is explaining how societies grew from, well, the whole thesis of the book is hunter-gatherers, who then became farmers, who then became bands of farmers, who then eventually became states. So it's the progression. How do those who run the states, the kings, the emperors, how do they retain power? He said, through history. And I want you to listen carefully to this because there are parallels in South Africa. Through history, there were really just four things that they focused on. The elites, or what he calls the kleptocrats. First, disarm the population and arm the elite. If you read BizNews, you'll see that there's been a lot of conversation and debate recently about guns. There is one side of the population, that is one side of the argument, an academic, who says you must give up your guns. I did. If you remember back in the before 94, where there was a gun-free South Africa initiative, and we all went, those of us who had firearms for protection, we gave them away because this was going to be the new world. Well, that was first level thinking. Second level thinking says, take it seriously, because through the history of mankind, elites have used this. Disarm the populace, arm the elite. One of the strong protagonists on the pro-gun lobby is a guy called Ian Cameron, who I'm sure you all know. He was one of the bravest people I know, and he's actually going to Parliament this year. He's very high up on the DA's provincial list and will be hopefully taking on Tele in Parliament after May the 29th. The second approach, remember the only four, was make the masses happy by redistributing much of the tributes received in popular ways. Tributes, taxes. The Romans knew all about this. They had an empire for hundreds of years. And so did others. Well, our guys just used social grants, of which 19 million South Africans received them. Remember the COVID grant. The COVID grant went to millions more South Africans, and it was supposed to be for COVID, for the difficult times in COVID. Well, we all know what's happened there, or do we? It is continuing. The COVID grant has not been phased out as the temporary thing it should have been. Why? Well, look at what Diamond tells us about the way that kleptocrats and elites retain power. The third one, he says, use the monopoly of force to promote happiness by maintaining public order and curbing violence. Now, you've got to think back here 13,000 years to when all of this began. And in all of that time, all of the societies that managed to retain power, the elites who retained power, they used their monopoly on force. Because what is a state? A state is an organization that has a monopoly on force. And the fourth one, oh, by the way, there, the obvious issue is, well, Bekele is keeping his job, even though he's doing a terrible job. Why? Because of the monopoly on force. And the fourth point that Jared Diamond makes is, he says, construct an ideology or religion justifying kleptocracy. Well, we have BEE. And if you wonder whether BEE is not the action of a kleptocrat, just have a look what's happening to estate agents right now. Those of you who don't know, it is a proposal, recommendation from the authorities that estate agents have to be 51% BEE. Otherwise, they will not get a Fidelity Fund certificate, which means they cannot practice. So for the first time, the very first time in South Africa, up to now it's been recommended. One of the speakers at the BizNews conference was Anthea Jeffrey. Again, I recommend you read her book. Read her book on socialism. She talks about the National Democratic Revolution. It's not something that was thought of and then discarded, as many people in the DA seem to think it has been. It is the core of ANC policy, the National Democratic Revolution. Turn us into Cuba. Sounds like I'm becoming a politician, but my goodness, there are so many smart people in our country who have written so many good things, but with first-level thinking, we never discover that. We never think that further. And you guys in this room, you've got people who look up to you, your children, your grandchildren, and they say, Grandpa, should I stay in South Africa now that I've got my social science degree or my computer science degree? And you say, no, it's a terrible place. Go and make England richer, or go and make America richer. Whereas instead, you should be looking, I think, at your responsibility of changing this society. Society only gets changed by the people who apply second level thinking, never, ever first level thinking. So there we go. You got your four criteria. If you look at everything in a different light now, you might say, oh, okay, it isn't the conspiracy theorists. This is the way that elites and kleptocrats have worked for thousands of years. And there's not a heck of a lot different going on in our country. I'll just take you to national health insurance as a, again, using second level thinking. First level thinking. Of course, we all want to have everybody in the country to have the best possible health and to have the best possible care. Of course we do. It is the easiest thing in the world to sell to a population. But we in South Africa now have legislated. It won't come into force because constitutionally they're going to really struggle and they'll be caught up in courts for many, many years, one hopes. But we've legislated something that the Premier of Gauteng can go and talk to a group like this and say to the people in the audience, on the 30th of May, you can go to any hospital in the country. You can get any health care you like, and the government will pay. Now, you doubt that? Well, that is, it was recorded, and Musi Maimani, who was another of our speakers at our conference, distributed that on his line. And it was Lesufi talking himself. So there we go. Nice election ploy. But just consider for a minute national health insurance. Many of the South African exiles spent time in the UK, and they really love the NHI of the UK. And there's a lot to like about it. But now apply second level thinking to that. The NHI in the UK costs the country £230 billion a year. Okay, £230 billion a year. That works out to 5.3 trillion rand. All the taxes that were received by the government last year, all the taxes, every cent, was 1.7 trillion rand. So we now want national health insurance like the UK has. And by the way, the Brits, okay, maybe they just do complain, you know, as part of their lifestyle, but the Brits say it's not good enough. Here in South Africa, we would have to take every cent of tax that was spent last year, treble it, and then we would get to the level of national health insurance in the UK. But then you take it one step further. So in other words, that means it's 300% of South Africa's total tax take. In the UK, 20% of their national budget is spent on national health insurance. 20%. It's a lot, but it's only 20% relative to 300%. So you stop and you think and you ask yourself, okay, well, costs are lower in South Africa, second level thinking. We can get away with less than they spend in the UK. Okay, because costs are lower. True. But the minute you have somebody working for the state anywhere in the world, they will look at another state employer as an alternative. And if you are a doctor working in South Africa for the state, why would you work here for a fraction of the income that you could get working, doing the same job in the UK, for instance, or France, or other countries that are similarly positioned? So second level thinking. NHI, what is it? It's a lovely election ploy, as is the BEE for estate agents, but there's a lot of belief behind it within the kleptocrats who run this country. And you look at me and say, hey, but I'm ANC, man. I've always voted for the ANC. What are you calling them kleptocrats? I have two words for you, Zondo Commission. Please read those. You know, there's just so much information that is available. We are a democracy. We have got freedom of information. But if we don't read it and we don't inform ourselves, well, then we deserve, I guess, not. Or we deserve to be acted upon, not to act upon. I want to go back to Jared Diamond now, because another big story on the political front is the Western Cape. you've heard, and maybe some of you even supporters of Cape independence. So where does this all come from? We had a guy actually at our conference, Phil Craig, who made, I thought, a compelling argument for Cape independence. His whole idea was very simple. He says, if you can take the national government and the people who run the national government and the parties who run the national government, and then you take the Western Cape, and those parties who decide on your laws are a tiny minority in the Western Cape. So why should the Western Cape be run along the same lines as people who actually do not have the support of the people in this area? So let's vote on it. That's all he says. Let's vote on it and make a decision. Now, I'm not one way or the other, but I do want to just share with you this very interesting fact from Jared Diamond's book. So remember, it's all about the last 13,000 years of humanity and how humanity went from being hunter-gatherers to having societies where they grew food. And interestingly enough, it all happened simultaneously, he writes. And by the way, you know, who's Jared Diamond? Where's he getting his information from? Archaeologists and more recently linguists. Because what linguists are able to do is have a look at how languages have developed. And in that way, they can see when certain products or certain issues came into a language. For instance, just use camel as an example. If there were they're all termed as whites, by the way, the Eurasians, from China all the way through to Europe and in Africa north of the Sahara. If those people then traded camels with what we know as, it's called the Niger-Congo group or the blacks in the terminology of humanity, then if it arrived later, if the camels arrived later, they would use the same word that the people in the north had been using all that time. So you can work it through in language. So you've got archaeology, which we all know about in this country, and this area is very rich in it. And then you have linguistics. And through that, you can join the dots, and he's done it. So what happened here in Africa is very interesting. Around the time of Christ, the Bantu had already moved from a little area between Cameroon and Nigeria down through Africa. They subsumed the Pygmies, who were one of the six. There were six major streams of humanity. Aboriginal Australians were the only ones not present in Africa. The Asians, incidentally, from Borneo, had colonized Madagascar. I think of that as a human feat. Jared Diamond says it was the greatest migration in history, and no one seems to know about it. But the Borneo people had somehow gotten from Borneo to Madagascar 2,000 years ago. It's an extraordinary book. It's well worth reading it. But the Bantu people had come through, subsumed the Pygmies. The Pygmies do not have a language anymore. They were at one stage in equatorial Africa. They now speak languages of the tribes that they kind of came into contact with. We came all the way down, and by the time of Christ, black people were already in situ in South Africa, but only as far as the Fish River. Why is that? South of the Fish River, i.e. the Western Cape, were the Khoisan. And there are still remnants of the Khoisan in Tanzania. People up there with their languages, which are Khoisan languages. How's that happened? Well, they got subsumed, but they still stayed there. So you can see, he argues, how humanity was moved down. And the Khoisan were then on the Western Cape. This is the time of Christ. But my history book, which were, okay, admittedly, I went to Newcastle High, so who knows. But I was told that the whites and the blacks met each other at the Fish River, and you had the first Xhosa War, which was in 1779. And that was what would everything happen. But what if you read Jared Diamond, you understand what he's written in these 550 words. The migration was supported by the plants you were able to grow. And those plants were taken from nature. So of all the areas, the six areas around the world where agriculture began, the most productive of all of them was what is called the Fertile Valley, which is the Tigris and Euphrates River. And in the Fertile Valley, in the Fertile Crescent was the first production of wheat, barley, beans, peas, and grapes. In West Africa, the production there was of sorghum and millet, pearl millet. And so you could migrate with your animals, with your domesticated animals, that's a whole new other story as well, but you could migrate if you could plant, and then you migrated at the rate of 0.7 miles a year. Okay, so this didn't happen. People didn't just up sticks and say, hey, we're going east, and then land somewhere else. They migrated slowly as populations grew, and as you had more food to feed the population and so on. So here we've got the guys who come from West Africa who are producing sorghum and millet, which doesn't grow in the Western Cape. So they stopped at the Fish River because these are not Mediterranean crops. And you can't just find a new crop to grow from nowhere in an area which has a different climatic approach. So what happened was then the Europeans came to the Western Cape and they brought with them the Mediterranean crops from the Fertile Crescent. Now this is an interesting observation because we have a part of South Africa which is very different to the rest of South Africa that was put together in 1910 by the British. And today is now saying, but hang on, we're not really part of these guys up north. Don't really love socialism in the way they do. We're a bit pissed off with social grants. We think that you should be meritorious, and that's why the Western Cape has got such strong support for the only political party here in the country that supports all of those ideas. Very, very interesting. Second level thinking. I want to finish off with just a couple more, and then maybe we can have a chat about this because I can see some disbelief in... No, I can't. I mean, I can see you all getting this. But the history of the last 13,000 years also explains, when you use second-level thinking, why there is such income disparity around the world. Certain societies did not have a head start. Others did. The Aboriginals were in Australia for 40,000 years when a more advanced society, because they had... Australia didn't have anything that they could grow. So they were always hunter-gatherers. A little bit like the Khoisan, a little bit like the Pygmies. It's a tough place to be in any world when a hunter-gatherer comes up against the guys who have got an organized system, because you have to have that for agriculture. It's the reality of what happened in Australia. What happened subsequent to that is just awful. And in this country as well. But eventually, if you apply second-level thinking, although the Khoi Khoi were virtually wiped out by smallpox, 95% of them lost their lives because of this disease. Eventually that disease was going to get them. Because it was the part of his book where he talks about germs go. And if you have a society that is not immune to it, it is going to wipe you out. So you might blame the Europeans for coming to South Africa and bringing the germs, but it could just as well have been Asians doing the same thing. Interesting. When you then have a look at the head start that this band has, how did it happen? How did it happen that Europe and the United States, who've got 10% of the world of society, have got 50% of the world's wealth? How? It's just And that is actually the story that started Diamond's mission. Talking a lot about him, but I think there's a lot in this book that actually is so relevant to us here in South Africa. Well, the reason there, he explains, is it's much, much easier to go west to east than it is north to south when you're a farmer, when you're an agriculturalist, because the difference in the climate is so much less when you're moving across. Hence, you had this move from west to east, from Asia all the way back to Europe, where they then used innovation, inventions, they changed things. They learned about gunpowder from the Chinese. They learned about writing from the Muslims, and so on and so forth. But to go north to south, not so easy. And when you have a look at the world, you will see that the difference is the concentration of wealth is from those societies. And then you take it one step further and you look at governance systems in the most recent time. For most of history, China has been by far the richest nation on earth. But then they did some crazy things like introduce communism, squashing human ingenuity, whereas the Americans, who had 0% of GDP in 1770, 0% of global GDP in 1770, and now they have 25%. Why? Well, they brought in a system to promote human ingenuity, unlock the potential that exists in each one of us as human beings. It's there, we can all use it, but sometimes the kleptocrats don't want us to use it. The kleptocrats want us to operate differently on those four principles I spoke about before. There's a wonderful story on second level thinking on BizNews this morning, written by R.W. Johnson, who's an Oxford Don. People really understand the caliber of or the status of this man. He taught a great number of the people who have dominated British politics. He was an anti-apartheid activist who went to the UK on a Rhodes Scholarship a week before the two pals that he had with him were arrested, so he would have been arrested as well. He then stayed in England because he wasn't welcome in his home, well, back in South Africa. He'd come here from England as a young boy. And he then became an Oxford professor for more than a quarter of a century. In 1994, when things changed, he came back home. And he has been just in a different league when it comes to analysis of South African issues as well as international developments. I love it when RW sends us a piece for publication. My accountant doesn't love it because obviously doesn't come cheap, but I can assure you that everything that we get from RW Johnson is just, it's just a joy to read such incredible insights. And his latest piece that he has today, he talks a little bit about Brexit. And you might recall that when Brexit happened in 2016, we all said, because what? You know, this wasn't supposed to happen. It's a bit like a Trump getting elected in America. Brexit wasn't supposed to happen. Well, RW argues that it always was going to happen because in 1973, when Britain went into the European Union, it was under the impression that it was going to create a troika, Britain, France, Germany, and that Britain and France would offset Germany and then they would actually be well-balanced, they'd have proper defense, proper technology, etc. Says, but unfortunately, the Brits found out very quickly that that wasn't the way the French and the Germans wanted to do things and that they always went off in a huddle, the French and the Germans. So eventually, the British started complaining, something, of course, that they're not very good at. And as a consequence of that, the seeds were sown. In 2016, they left. It's a disaster on so many levels. But right now, it's a huge disaster because you've got a guy over the border, a very well personification of a kleptocrat who's been in power for, what's it going on, for 30 years now. And that guy over the border says, let me test these chaps. Let me invade Ukraine. Let me just kill, I don't know how many people he's killing, but whatever, that's all happening. So Europe's panicking and Europe's saying, oh, we used to get all our energy from these guys. Can't do that anymore. Oh, what are we going to do about defense? Germany today, this morning, announced that it has promised the Baltic states that if Putin invades, it will defend them. Isn't that interesting? So suddenly you've got a defenseless Europe that's now having to start making plans to have its own defense. I remember having a lunch with Alec Irwin. Does anyone remember that guy, Alec Irwin? And at the time, we were in the euphoria, the Mandela era, and he was arguing very strongly for not cutting arms spending. And I remember saying to him, Minister, I think we used to call him, or Minister, we used to call him in those days, "Wow, we got no enemies." He said, "No state should be defenseless. No state should put itself in a position where somebody else could invade and take advantage." And the Ukrainians did that themselves. They gave up their nuclear weapons. Remember, they were the third biggest nuclear weapon armory in the world. They gave them up because they were promised by the West and the Russians that if anybody invaded them, they would be defended by the West and the Russians. Oh, yeah. Nice that one turned out. Anyway, second level thinking. When you look back on that, you shake your head. But, you know, you're going to find any number of guys who've sucked in the stuff from the troll factories telling you why Putin's a good guy. You know, 30 years of one man, one party, strongman rule, really good. And we have a guy in South Africa with at least 10% of the vote telling us that we are Putin and Putin is us. We do know that the Russians are interfering in our election. We know that for sure. Interesting. What happens over there? You remember there's that lovely saying that when a butterfly flutters its wings in the Amazon, there can be a tornado in Australia. Those are issues that second-level thinking will at least help you to understand. You can't change it. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can. Second-level thinking puts you on that planet. And finally, unemployment in South Africa. This is one of my favorite topics. The United States had its Great Depression. We still read about it today. At the time of the Great Depression in 1933, the worst possible time for the Americans, where there were soup kitchens, there were people dying of starvation. The unemployment rate was 24.9%. Just hold that one side. South Africa's unemployment rate officially today is 32.1%. But we have no soup kitchens. Well, we got some churches who are helping the poor. We have no people dying for sure of poverty. We have no revolutions. Why? Well, I like what G.G. Alcock says. G.G. Alcock is a guy who grew up in a mud hut in Masinga. How did he start life as a mud hut in a mud hut in Masinga? Well, his father, who was a well-qualified medical doctor, who came from a family of farmers, gave up their farm in the Drakensberg area because he was an activist. He believed, he really, really believed that South Africa needed changing. We're talking now about the 60s. And so he broke with all of that. He and his wife went to the poorest area they could find, Masinga, which is populated by the Zulus who fought with the British at Isandlwana. So you must know, if you fight with the British at Isandlwana, you are going to be punished
when the Zulus come back into power, for obvious reasons. By the way, the Zulus won at Isandlwana. So that's Masinga. They said no, but they're not really accepted, and they don't get much help. But Dr. Elmgott decided he would go live there. And he brought up Gigi and his brother in a house with no running water, no electricity, but lots and lots of books. Lots and lots of books. So Gigi grew up as a white Zulu, and he's written some beautiful books about his experience, third world child, that we then had very, very much of a capitalist. When he then came to the city, he stayed as Johnny Clegg lived in the hostels because that reached people. And slowly but surely, he started holding a name for himself as somebody who actually understood what is going on. Get the heat forward, everybody. And when he talks to you, and he often, he's coming with us to London, we're actually doing a conference in London on Wednesday. Really talks, gently gives you a very fresh perspective, a second level thinking perspective on South Africa. Not this 32.1% unemployment rate, which is, well, a quarter higher, again, from the highest unemployment rate that we've seen in history. By the way, it's not just us who've been told this, but when you Google who has the highest unemployment in the world, it will come up as South Africa, number one. And you know, that worthy nation of Djibouti. And in fact, like 6% is much higher than the West Bank and Gaza. Hey, well, Jetty will say to you, but it is an economy that you guys don't even know exists. There's a thing called backroads. What does a backroad sound? Sounds like many of you, when you're at, I could go on and on and talk about things like, you know, minimum wages and what that's done to the society. But when you had a backroad where you had somebody, a helper, used to call it a maid, but they're a help, you know, helping, a tire. That's what the immediate thorn is amongst people from a different area. But when you go to the back room, say, hey, that's fuck with them. These are little fratlets that have been born there with Wi-Fi, air conditioning, little kitchen, small, but rented out by the owner of the house. And some of these people are mobiles. She brought a lady in who had a back room business. Who was generating, it was about 300,000 rand a month of rentals. She wanted to add on to a new, basically called another little, it's like a little hotel, little hotels, little apartments, that the banks would, but give her a billion rand, she tells us, a billion rand to buy a bar, but they won't give her any money to build a back up. You have bakers, you have people on the side of the road who are feeding those who are going into their jobs through the hundreds of thousands of pence. You have a huge, huge, huge economy that is belting. And yet, South Africa, we tell ourselves, has higher unemployment by far than the American state in the Great Britain. Gigi puts it into perspective for me when he says, I asked the lady, do you have a job? She said, I work, but I don't have a job. And that's the reality of South Africa's unemployment. By the way, he puts it, the true unemployment in South Africa, well, the same. Now that would correlate with the relative stability that we have as a society. We had that phase in rights, but we know that those were in the shared by the balance. And other committees been like, we had a wonderful talk at the business conference at the Dropitz movie a couple of years ago by Jason Corbett. Jason, the Corbett property crew has got nearly of these shopping centers in KZF, a number of which were raised to the ground. And Jason showed us a movie and it's fun business TV, so I'd watch it. We were really great for this session. But he said when the guys arrived there, it wasn't the masses who came or the crowds, it was a little advanced force with high power rifles who shot out the, first of all, they knocked out the sprinkler system. And they knew exactly what they were doing. It was very well planned. The KZN riots didn't just happen because people were cross. The KZN riots happened because people took advantage of the situation. We live in an amazing country. It's just the most incredible place in the world. And as an artist, I'll work. All of you are testament, must be testament to how, with a little bit of decent governance, you could live a very full and happy life in our country. But if you're going to let yourself get sucked in by first-level thinking, if you're not going to challenge yourself, and those who rely on your opinions, more importantly, those children and grandchildren who look at you and say, Bob, why is this happening this way? And instead of spraying back to it something that you've just been sent by a troll from, you might take a little while to reflect and consider a bit of second level thinking. This is a wonderful country and a wonderful world, and we are advancing. But that doesn't mean that the hypocrites who keep dominating society for 13,000 years in certain areas have suddenly left the state.
Benfica.